Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
All right, thank you very much. Kim Gordon in the newsroom. She'll be back with the headlines at 12:30 and then look at the numbers a little bit later in the program. Thanks very much for tuning in as we sit here on this beautiful Thursday afternoon in the Allstate Showcase Studio. When's the last time you went to a craft brewery? Maybe a better question is, when's the last time you went out and did not go to a craft brewery? In just 5 years, the number of craft breweries in Illinois has expanded by, wait for this, 350%. The executive director of the Illinois Craft Brewers Guild is on a phone line now. Danielle D'Alessandro, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, Steve. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So you guys are exploding, and that brings a number of questions to me, but just tell me about the growth of all of this. Is it in one particular area? Is it statewide? Or what's hot right now when it comes to microbreweries and craft beers?
Sure, definitely. I mean, 5 years ago, there were around 50 breweries that were primarily located in the Chicagoland area. And you're right, today we have over 230 breweries located throughout the state. We have over 50 that are still in Chicago, but we've seen that explode not only in the suburbs, but in downstate, central Illinois, and even upstate. So it's been pretty incredible.
And there's an economic impact, right? I mean, it's getting big enough to now where that you can measure it. It has a real impact on the state.
Absolutely. The industry has contributed $2.6 billion in 2016 and supports over 16,000 jobs, ranging from manufacturing to agriculture to hospitality and tourism.
So here's the thing. You know, it used to be when you would go to a craft brewery, and I'm thinking, Danielle, primarily restaurants, brew pubs. I don't know if that's, I mean, I think you probably represent others than that as well. But, you know, it used to be kind of an event. Oh, yeah, they make their own beer, too. Now, it's almost, it's not that it's expected, but it's nearly routine. And I wonder if there becomes a saturation point to where it's no longer done to bring people in. It's no longer such a marketing thing because it's not that unique.
You know what? Some folks are starting to question, you know, have we reached a saturation point? And I would actually answer with an emphatic no. We have over 6,300 breweries now in the United States. And again, with over 230 in Illinois, we still have another 20 or so that are slated to open this year or next. So local is still incredibly important and is still an incredible driver of consumers wanting to experience that quality, that freshness right out of the brew pub or the tap room.
Yeah, I mean, it is just incredible. I was in a tap room last week, in fact, but it's just incredible what's happened to beer and the way we drink our beer these days. It's really, mm-hmm. It's very exciting. How is Illinois when it comes to how difficult it is to open a brew pub in Illinois? I mean, regulations favor it. Is it difficult? Tell me about that.
That's a good question. Every state is different. Based on the 21st Amendment, the federal government gives states the ability to regulate their own alcohol industry. So Illinois is going to be very different from Michigan or from Indiana. I would say that we actually have some pretty favorable laws. We continue to work and change those to be more favorable, though, for the growth and expansion of craft beer. We've worked on a couple of different legislative pieces over the last few years. In 2015, for example, the Guild worked with the Associated Beer Distributors of Illinois to pass legislation allowing breweries to make up to 120,000 barrels of beer per year while still operating up to 3 retail locations. Previously, that had been limited to just 30,000 barrels, which stifled growth. We're working on legislation this year, actually, that would allow tap rooms to be able to sell craft beer and ciders manufactured at other breweries. State law currently only allows you to sell what you manufacture on site. And so this is exciting because it has the potential to promote collaboration among breweries and even allow tap rooms to offer a gluten-free cider option for guests who, you know, can't consume gluten or who just prefer something other than beer.
That's an interesting thing. So I was in a tap room and we're running short on time, but last week, and for the first time, a buddy of mine went out and we got there and it's like, well, this isn't quite what we were hoping for. It was a tap room. There are a couple of taps there, not many other options, and so we didn't end up staying. So what you're saying is that you're looking for legislation that might allow a tap room to become a little more bar-like.
A little bit. So they still wouldn't be able to sell other types of alcohol. But when they're collaborating with other breweries or, again, want to be able to offer a gluten-free option, we're providing that opportunity. I do just want to say quickly, too, that the great thing about tap rooms is it's really not even just about the beer. It's about the experience.
Yeah.
I was at a tap room myself up in the northwest suburbs on a Saturday, and there was a family of four, and the parents each had their own flight of beer, and the kids had pop, and they were playing a board game. And you just can't get that type of experience in a lot of, you know, in your traditional tavern or restaurant.
That is an excellent point, because my experience, too, was it felt more like a pub, an Irish or British pub, where it was just a sort of a place to hang out a little bit. Hey, one of the reasons we're on the phone, too, is because this is the first Illinois Craft Beer Week. It's sort of in conjunction with Chicago Craft Beer Week, but that kicks off tomorrow, right?
It does, yeah. Thank you for asking. We have our cornerstone event, Beer Under Glass, at the Garfield Park Conservatory. We have a closing event next Friday, May 25th, Good Libations, a tropical-themed festival at Theater on the Lake. So this is really an expansion of Chicago Craft Beer Week. Again, with over 230 craft breweries in Illinois, our members and consumers across the state wanted to get involved. So there's hundreds of events, activities, drink specials, not just in Chicago, but throughout the state that people can check out, whether it's breweries playing dodgeball, food and beer pairings, or tap takeovers. There's definitely something for everybody.
Danielle D'Alessandro is the executive director of the Illinois Craft Brewers Guild. It was great to talk to you. I hope we can do it again.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
A little bit later in the show, we'll go out west to CNET's headquarters and talk to senior editor Ian Scher there about a number of things. He's got a piece about this is, I think today is Accessibility Day when it comes to the tech industry, and he's got a piece on that we'll talk to him about, and the net neutrality vote in the Senate as well. Right now, let's jump on a Lyft train. A Lyft train, is that possible? Joe Sweeterman is on a phone line. He's the director at the Chaddick Institute for Metropolitan Development and a professor of School of Public Service at DePaul. I'm going to call him the transportation guy from DePaul. Joe, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
I appreciate that. It's a fun place to be in downtown Chicago studying transportation.
Well, and so you've been looking. I know you guys had a study out looking at the CTA and also at the rideshare programs, Uber and Lyft, and you are suggesting sort of that the CTA co-opt Uber and Lyft or borrow from them, or what exactly is it you're looking at here?
Yeah, that's what we looked at and found that, you know, ride sharing is, of course, flourishing everywhere, but it's a pretty expensive ticket for a lot of people. And we looked at how much you pay more than the CTA to use Uberpool and Lyft, Lyft Line and so forth, and found that it's on a per-hour basis, you're spending a lot of money. So most commuters, you know, still use transit for their, you know, their daily trips downtown and things. And there's exceptions. There's markets you can't get to on transit. But the value proposition for just, you know, the typical commuter is it makes it pretty expensive.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah. You know, but there are times when the transit just doesn't work. I mean, you look at late at night, you look at some transit deserts, you look at people who are just not comfortable on buses and trains. And we're trying to encourage the CTA to, you know, take some baby steps to start letting ride-sharing do what it does best, and the CTA does what his best. And things like working ride-sharing onto the Ventra app is a good example of that. And other cities are doing that sort of thing.
So you would have, so maybe allow the Ventra card to be used for Uber rides?
Yeah, some cities have developed apps, right. So if you want to go from point A to point B, it says you can take transit, here's your choices, or you can take an Uber or Lyft to a transit stop and then jump on the red line, and here's what it would cost and about how much time it would take. And this is sort of trying to integrate the two together in a way that gets people who might otherwise just take an Uber and Lyft the whole way, you know, to combine the trips.
I can understand why the CTA might have incentive to do that, but would there be incentive for Uber or Lyft to do that?
You know, we're talking to ride-sharing companies, and they really want to be seen as not the enemy. They really are looking to be seen as part of the urban mobility puzzle we're trying to solve. And it's tough because studies show, you know, there's congestion issues, there's transit ridership's been really flat. But things like, you know, CTA bus ridership have been pretty soft lately. And one thing where we propose, for example, is late at night, you know, when bus service is really bad, you know, once every half hour or so,
right.
And people aren't too willing to take an L to a stop and wait 20 minutes for a bus, that you develop a system where there would be a very modest discount if you want a ride share to an outlying CTA stop, so you at least get people on transit for the bulk of their trip.
What are the chances, do you think, of there being some sort of, I don't want to use the term, I'm going to use the term merger, but I don't mean full merger, but some sort of cooperation in the near future?
Well, we think you got to get started down the path of just seeing what cooperation could look like. And right now, our region effectively has nothing, and we're falling behind. I mean, Detroit last week just announced something very similar to what we propose. We could take a Lyft to a transit stop, and there's a financial incentive to do that. Other cities have actually offered to pay for part of your rides if you are going to certain areas where bus service is weak. We don't think any kind of subsidy to ride sharing is at all what we're talking about. We're talking about baby steps, so we don't have these two systems just on totally different trajectories, right, and then people ditch the train as a result.
Joe Sweeterman from DePaul University. It's great to talk to you, Joe. Thank you very much.
Good talking.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
Do you have a college graduate? Have you been to a college graduation so far this spring and then watch the graduates go out and try to find a job? The jobs are everywhere, right? They're everywhere. We'll talk to Elise Glink about the current job situation coming up a little bit later in the program, but thank goodness Ian Scher is already employed at CNET.com. He joins us on most Thursdays to talk about what's going on in the tech world. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well. I want to start with what happened in Washington. I think it was yesterday. The Senate picked up a couple of Republican votes, a few Republican votes really, and ended up passing this extension of the net neutrality law, the regulation that the Trump administration wants to get rid of, the Senate voted to keep, right?
Yes. Yeah, so it first off, it's not a law, it's a regulation. And it was created by the Obama FCC a few years ago because they wanted to make sure that people like Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, all of them could not control the way that traffic is handled on their sites. You know, the power company has to give you power no matter whether you're using a Black & Decker or a whatever toaster. And, the air company has to, you know, all this stuff. Water has to go through whatever you have. They want the internet to be the same. So the Trump administration pulled it back. That was back in December. The law, the new regulation hasn't kicked in yet. But now we see the Senate trying to change that. The vote yesterday was 52-47,
but here's
which
the
was
thing.
A pretty big deal.
Yeah, but Ian, it really doesn't matter, right? I mean, the House isn't going to go along. The president's,
the president's got to
sign it. So this is really just a political thing that the Democrats can use campaigning. It's not really going to lead to a rescinding of the president of the FCC order.
You hit the nail on the head. This is about campaigning. And look, a lot of people on the internet were very happy yesterday, but it's a symbolic vote. It's very unlikely that anything's actually going to happen here. And what it means, more than anything, I think, is that the next time there's a Democrat who's the president, we're probably going to see another shift to the other side. And it's just going to keep going back and forth and back and forth until there's a law passed. I will point out, though, more than 80% of this country in polls say they support net neutrality. So what's interesting here is that the Trump administration is going against the will of a majority of the American public.
Right. Well, I mean, I suppose they are, and I probably agree with those polls, but I don't know how fervently. I mean, I don't know if it's going to cost them to do this, right? Because the president says
that's the problem.
This is
we
good for business and donors and all that. All right. So today is Global Accessibility Awareness Day, which is being paid attention to in the world of tech. You wrote a piece about that personally. So tell me about the day and about what you discovered.
Yeah, there's a couple of really big, interesting ones. First off, Apple and Facebook and Google and Microsoft and Adobe are all teaming up to launch an accessibility program for children, right, to help them learn as they are in school, which is really great, right? Seeing tech companies really kind of dig in and help is a really big thing. And I actually interviewed Microsoft's head of accessibility, which we have a story on CNET about, and she talked about how the efforts that have been going on in the last few years to really make tech more accessible and easier to use for people with disabilities has helped all of us and has made it better for everyone. A good example is closed captioning, right? It's gotten way better in the last few years. And I watch it closed captioning all the time on TV and on movies. And right. So I really like it.
Yeah. Any show from Scotland or England, I've got the closed captioning on.
Exactly. And then the other thing is that Microsoft itself released this really interesting device. It's $99. It's called an adaptive controller. And what it is it's designed for people with disabilities to be able to play video games. The video game industry broadly has always assumed that you have two very functioning hands to be able to play games.
Right.
And that's just not possible for a lot of people. And so, the interesting thing here, I actually went up to Redmond in Washington in Microsoft's headquarters, saw the device, talked to a few people who are disabled, including an Army vet who had a spinal cord injury, doesn't have control of his fingers. And he had a really interesting time showing me how this device works. So it's really interesting to see the tech industry really push forward on this.
Yeah, you would think it's a natural marriage. I mean, the tech industry in helping the disabled.
Absolutely.
I do like to watch British shows, British crime dramas and something. It's just a quirky thing in my head. I don't know why. But every time there's a crime, the police investigate and they say, well, let's get the CCTV. Let's get the closed circuit television. And so now here's the story out of England about the Metropolitan Police using facial recognition software from images, I guess, they would gather from CCTV and elsewhere. And the fact that it's inaccurate 98% of the time, that's a big percent.
That's a huge percent. And the reason it's coming out of the UK, by the way, is that the UK is one of the most self-surveilled societies in the world, right? They have cameras everywhere. And so it's actually a really good kind of sense of how bad this is. So this came from a public information request from the independent newspaper in the UK. And as you mentioned, they found that a vast majority of all of the times that they do facial recognition through these cameras, they get it wrong. And just another data point, South Wales Police, which, right, Wales is in the UK,
sure.
They found more than 2,400 false positives since they started using it in June 2017.
So, of course,
the police, well, go ahead.
Are they convicting people on this?
No, it doesn't. This is still in a testing phase, thank God. but, you know, the police have actually said that the great quote that came out of the biometrics commissioner for the UK said, quote, it's not yet fit for use. And I think that's the understatement of the day there.
So we'll watch for that. And hopefully it's not coming to a street corner near you anytime soon. Everyone's been talking about the Yanny Laurel thing. And I know I've seen some software where they actually divide it into a couple of tracks and explain it. And that's up at CNET, too, right?
Right. So we actually, what we found is that the New York Times came up with this really amazing tool. We have a link to it on CNET, so you can easily find it, that will actually change the frequency of what it is. I have been having a hard time over the last couple of days because I only hear Laurel. And I've actually been listening to, like, the different distorted ones where they say you can hear Yanny. I don't hear it. I think everyone's crazy. And so the New York Times actually created a tool. I finally heard Yanny, so I feel like I understand the crazy world that all you other people live in.
Yeah, I was going to say that cracks me up because I cannot for the life of me hear Laurel. All right, buddy boy, nice to talk to you. Let's do it again next week.
Absolutely. Take care.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing the news, providing input, and breaking down the stories that matter to the world of business. Here's one for the little guys. Deerfield-based snack maker Mondelez International met last week with their shareholders and 55% denied an executive bonus package worth $60 million. One vote. It was as simple as that. This is a pretty rare experience for the corporate world, but it does happen. And it reminds you, if you don't exceed expectations for your work, then you don't get the bonus. There are things to learn from this occasion, though. Times are changing from the old hardened business methods. And that's a lot of money they can use elsewhere. Maybe on marketing? And speaking of, Score Chicago is hosting a seminar emphasizing the importance of video marketing on the internet. It's evident that video content is king and expected to be 75% of internet traffic by 2020. So knowing your way around it is vital for long-term success. Register for the free event now at Score Chicago and learn about video marketing on Monday 21st at 1 p.m. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Hey, welcome back to the Allstate Showcase Studio. It is 12:52. Elise Klink is on the phone line. Elise is the publisher of ThinkLink.com and the CEO of Best Money Moves. I don't know if you've checked that out yet, but Best Money Moves is this HR app for businesses. It helps workers measure their financial stress and then helps them deal with it, dial it down a little bit. Elise, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hey, Steve. Nice to be here.
Yeah, you know, it's sunny here. I know you're not in Chicago today, but it's beautiful. The sun is out. It's in the 70s, but I still am going outside with an umbrella over my head because, man, it's just rain and jobs. The jobs are everywhere. I mean, the jobs are in the street. The jobs are rolling through the hills. There are just jobs for anyone who wants one, Elise Klink.
There are. And, you know, what's interesting for employers is that employee retention is quickly becoming the number one issue. And that's because we are seeing people jump jobs. There are lots of opportunities to move. And if your employer, every time an employee leaves, it costs you money to find a new one. And it's costing more and more.
But is that true? Because every time I say that there are jobs everywhere, the people respond by saying, well, yeah, but it's not the jobs we want. It seems to me that maybe it is the jobs we want.
Well, I think that there are different parts of the economy. So if you are in computer sciences and you know how to code, you can basically walk across the street and get a $20,000 signing bonus, which is pretty nice. And that varies, and the amount that they're going to pay you, of course, will vary from what, you know, city you live in, but the pay there is pretty good. They just can't get enough of them. On the other hand, if you're working in a factory, those jobs are a little bit harder to come by. We're not doing a whole lot of manufacturing in the U.S. right now. So your level of education, your skill set, how good you are at writing, all of these things play into what kind of job opportunities are there for you.
I want to get to the writing in a second, but first, a statistic. The continuing claims, jobless claims, fell by 87,000 in the most recent survey by the Labor Department, the lowest since December of 1973, which is a long, long time. I mean, is this an historic jobs market that we're sitting in right now?
It is, and in Chicago, you know, we're looking sort of nationally at under 4% for unemployment, which is, economists will tell you all day long, that's an unsustainable pace. On the other hand, there's some states, and I think like North Dakota is one of them. There are some other states like Idaho where you're seeing unemployment at around 2% or under 3%. And that number truly is unsustainable. So something's going to have to give. You're either going to have to bring some more people to those areas to help them fill the jobs that are out there, or you're going to have to start paying people more money so that they stay. But there's these numbers are just unsustainable.
Governor Walker tweeted out this morning about his state's unemployment rate in Wisconsin at 2.8%. So one of those states you're talking about. Unsustainable, but what does that mean? Does that mean, as you said, just wages are going to go up, that there's going to be trouble with the economy, or what does unsustainable mean?
Well, there are some cities and towns that literally have 100 or 1,000 jobs open, and nobody is applying for those jobs. So some of those jobs are jobs that we might think of as being, you know, less than desirable, right? They're in places where they manufacture meat, right? So they're slaughterhouses, for example. Well, unless you're going vegan, you really need them to have those jobs filled so that they can process the cattle that comes in. So if they can process the cattle, then there's a backlog of cattle waiting to be produced. That affects the ranchers and the farmers, and then the feed for the farmers. So there's lots of different things that all come back to, you know, how many people are actually there to process the meat into the packages we buy at our local Jewel or, you know, wherever. And so there's lots of different hidden ripple effects to, you know, an employment number that is literally this low that you just have 1,000 jobs waiting to be filled.
You know, it doesn't help you maybe at the slaughterhouse, but very quickly, you mentioned writing earlier, and it's one thing to get a great STEM education. That's very valuable, but you always need to be able to communicate, and people who can write are people who can adapt and find jobs that fit them.
I have people all day long ask me, my kid's majoring in philosophy, or my kid is majoring in English, you know, what should I do? Is that okay? And the answer is, I majored in English literature. And yes, because again, writing is at the root of all of the white collar jobs that are out there. You've got to be able to formulate ideas, explain the idea, translate that idea into action plans, and people who have those kinds of great communication skills are the ones who are going to win in that kind of an environment.
Elise Klink, let's talk again next week.
You bet.